Good evening. My name is Ashley Teasdale, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Spanish Department, and the Office of Global Education, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, LGBT Rights in Spain, Writing and Social Change. Just 33 years ago, Francisco Franco, the reigning dictator of Spain, died, leaving the country that had been under his totalitarian rule since the 1930s open to change for the first time in 45 years. Franco's rule was characterized by a strict adherence to traditional values and nationalism. Minorities, such as the LGBT community, were targeted and persecuted. Homosexuality was more than illegal. As a result of censorship, its existence was barely even acknowledged. After Franco's death, Spain underwent a peaceful but fundamental political change by creating the constitutional monarchy it has today. This political change was accompanied by a more gradual but just as fundamental social movement called La Movida. Today, Spain has become one of the more socially tolerant countries in the world. It has enacted progressive legislation on gay and lesbian rights, including a law permitting same-sex marriage. What brought about this incredible social change? How could a country transition from extreme social conservatism to such liberal views in less than 35 years? Writers have played a huge role in bringing about this social paradigm shift. Writing has the remarkable ability to both mimic and recreate popular culture and the social ideas behind it. Here to discuss the enormous role writing plays in the initiation and realization of social change is award-winning lesbian author Isabel Franc. In 1992, her novel, Entre Todas las Mujeres, was a finalist for La Sonrisa Vertical Award for an erotic narrative. Leading gay and lesbian Spanish journal, Shenge, granted her the Shenge Award for the best novel with a gay or lesbian theme. Her lesbian crime fiction trilogy, published under the pseudonym Lola Vanguardia, is one of the first of this genre in the Spanish language. Ms. Franc's works have been translated into French, Italian, and Portuguese, and perhaps soon also in English. Also with us this evening is Alberto Lopez, who will be translating for Ms. Franc when necessary. Mr. Lopez is a visiting international scholar in the Spanish department and is a professional translator and interpreter. At this time, I would like to ask that the sound be turned off on all cell phones and any other electronic devices. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation, when there will be a short question and answer session. Out of courtesy to those who are hearing impaired, and because we are taping this event, please raise your hand and wait until a microphone is passed to you before speaking. Thank you for your cooperation. And now, please join me in welcoming Isabel Franc.
Well, thank you very much. Can you hear me? Yes? Thank you very much to the Clark Forum. Thank you very much to Margaret. And thank you, everybody, to be here. Espero que nadie haya venido coaccionado.
She hope everyone here is here by your own will. No one came here. Yeah. Without wanting to be here.
I want to excuse myself because my English is very, very bad. I have been studying English only for 30 or 35 years, so you can understand my level is not very good. But, so I'm going to read my notes, and I'll try to explain me, and I hope you enjoy this moment. Thank you, everybody, to be here. I would like to begin with a question. What relationship can exist between writing and social change?
Isabel, perdón. ¿Funciona?
Better like this? Yeah? Okay. So, I would like to begin with a question. What relationship can exist between writing and social change? Obviously, if we consider writing is a political commitment, The answer is clear. They are brothers or sisters. In my case, to write is a political act. No doubt. I was born during a fascist dictatorship in a country in which one could not speak, and I belong to a family that did not speak. Outcome. When they steal your words, you are always looking for words. You are always looking for answers in words. During the Franco dictatorship, there was special laws. One called La Ley de Peligrosidad y Rehabilitación Social.
Mm-hmm. The Law of Social Danger. Mm-hmm.
And this law substituted another one called Ley de Vagos y Maleantes.
The law against tramps and social undesirables.
And all of these laws was for the control of all elements considered antisocial. And it included beggars, vandals, traffickers of drugs or of pornography, prostitutes, pimps, child abusers, illegal immigrants, and homosexual people, all of them in the same basket. Anyone who was considered morally or socially dangerous by the fascist regime could be detained under this law. The punishment for infringement of this law could be from a fine to penalties of 5 years in prison or in a psychiatric center for rehabilitation. In the last part of the Franco dictatorship, this law was substituted for another called La Ley del Escándalo Público.
The Law of Public Scandal. Mm-hmm.
So you can see all these names for the same objective. It was used systematically to repress homosexuality. You can see one imagine of this law, one of these laws. And the crime of public scandal included the home. It means you could be accused of public scandal even if the homosexual act had taken place in your bed, in your private house. During this period, gay collectives centered their fight on abolishing these laws. And that didn't happen completely until 1995, during the last year of the administration of Socialist President Felipe González. More than 5,000 people were detained for gay attitudes and acts during the Franco dictatorship. But this number is only a supposition because a lot of records were lost in the prisons and because on a lot of occasions, homosexuals were accused of prostitution or abuse. Aversion therapies were also used, like in the film A Clockwork Orange. It consisted of applying electric discharge while watching masculine pictures and positive stimulus when the image was of a woman, obviously for men. But what happened with women? Lesbians suffered strong social repression, but they were often overlooked. They didn't exist. You needed a magnifying glass to find them. Even now, lesbian women are invisible. And this is an advantage on some occasions, but is a problem in others. I'm going to tell you about my experience in this period, in this subject, because I lived through the end of the Franco period and I took part in the first demonstration of gay Pride celebrate in Barcelona the 26th of June 1977. I was very, 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 very young. Very young. A baby, practically. I don't know if can you see a baby carriage in the end? It's me. It was also the first LGBT demonstration in Spain. Remember, the law of social danger was abolished in 1995, so it was a dangerous demonstration. But people lived it like a party. Two of the most chanted slogans were, one of them was, "Somos cachondos, no peligrosos." Cachondos have a double sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cachondos can be horny or can be also hot. We're hot. So that was something like, "We are hot and horny, not dangerous."
And the other one was, "No somos machos, pero somos muchos." So we are not machos, but we are many. Mm-hmm. Obviously, more men than women. But something is something. You can see here another pictures about this moment, this demonstration. One, some women. And you can imagine the enormous change that there has been between this demonstration and these laws and the current situation. Now, gay people in Spain can legally marry, adopt children, or have a sex change operation. And also, transsexual people can change identity in their documents without going through the operating theater. This is a historical cover of magazine Zero. Zero is the most important gay magazine in Spanish language. And this is in the moment of when the gay marriage was accepted. And now I want to show you some pictures about the Euro Games. This is the last event in Barcelona. I'm going to talk a little bit in Spanish. Es el último acontecimiento que hemos tenido en Barcelona.
This has been the last event that we have had in Barcelona.
Son unos Juegos Olímpicos GLBT. Pero mucha gente dice, bueno, ¿por qué unos Juegos Olímpicos gays? ¿No? ¿Por qué unos Juegos Olímpicos especiales para gay people?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this sport event was actually, they are like Olympics, like the Olympics, but for the gay community. And some people ask themselves, but why do we need to have special Olympic games?
Mm. ¿Es una forma de autodiscriminación?
Is maybe a way to self-discriminate ourselves?
No, es una forma de visibilizar un hecho que existe.
No, in fact, it's a way to gain visibility about something that already exists.
Y es una forma de denunciar la homofobia, la tremenda homofobia que existe en el deporte.
And also it's a way to make visible the fact that in sports there is a lot of homophobia.
Mm-hmm. ¿Cuántos deportistas han hecho un coming out?
How many sport people have come out of the closet?
You can see more pictures. This is dancing room, because it's not only sport, but only other things. Synchronized swim.
Synchronized swimming.
So you can see this changes. We have need only 30 years, the time I have been studying English, no? to this change, to a fascist dictatorship, and in the same city to have this in the streets in everywhere. in a few times, a few times. Well, another question. What is the relationship between writing and having human rights? There is a poem, a Gabriel Celaya poem, La poesía es un arma cargada de futuro. I would like, me gustaría más que fuera un instrumento, una herramienta, pero bueno, aceptamos la metáfora.
Yeah, and she says that the translation that we have here for this poem by Gabriel Celada, poetry is a weapon loaded with future. She would prefer that instead of a weapon, it would be a tool. We should have used the word tool. Poetry is a tool loaded with future.
There is an affinity with sounds, maybe more obvious with my accent. Write and write. We can say write is right. Yeah? Mm-hmm. When we are writing, when you are writing, you have a power. Lots of people can read your feeling, can know what you are thinking about the world. Lot of people can receive what you are expressing. You can motivate lots of people with your stories, with your ideas. And this is a real, real power. The power to take part in social change. And this is also a great responsibility. This is why I think writing must be a social and a political commitment. Then you choose the way, choose the style, the resource, and I feel some humor. Because I think that with humor you can say more things and the public can recite more. So I think it's a good narrative strategy. And because I think life is very, very tragic, and a sense of humor is a good strategy also to survive. If you are writing, if you are a writer, woman, daughter of the Franquist regime, and lesbian, you have two options. Or you take your life with sense of humor, or you kill yourself. I started my literary career with a parody about miracles in Lourdes. I knew this subject very well because part of my family was fanatically Catholic. And every year, I had to endure a slide show with this picture where people went to Lourdes Sanctuary to receive a miracle. But the miracle never came to me, so I decided to write about this. In 1995, three women create the first publishing house of LGBT subject matter in the Spanish state. They asked me for a collaboration, and that's how Con Pedigree, with Pedigree, was born. It's the first book of the Lola Vanguardia trilogy. I want to explain why the pseudonym. Mm-hmm. En principio no pensábamos poner un pseudónimo, pero tuvimos esta idea porque había muchos personajes reconocibles dentro de la novela y también porque queríamos que la gente especulara un poco sobre la autoría de este libro. Fue una decisión conjunta entre la editorial y la autora que era yo.
Mm-hmm. Right, so she's explaining why she used a pseudonym for this novel. Initially, they were not going to, I mean, it was a common decision taken between the publishing company, the publishers, and the author. They were not going to use a pseudonym in the beginning, but then they realized that there were many characters in the novel who could be recognized as people in real life. So they thought, well, this would also maybe make people speculate more about who was the author, and they then decided that they will use a pseudonym.
Just a joke. Better? Mm-hmm. Just a joke. Pero el éxito de esta novela provocó que hubiera una segunda, the second one, luego una tercera.
So it all started as a joke between the publishers and the author. But then the first book that she published was so successful that then there was a second book and then a third book. And the pseudonym was kept throughout.
La primera de ellas, con Pedigrí, en la primera edición tenía un subtítulo. Era Culebrón Lésbico por Entregas. Con Pedigrí, Culebrón Lésbico por Entregas.
Okay, so the first book, the first novel, which was titled with Pedigrí, it had actually a subtitle to it, which was something like Lesbian Soap Opera by Installments, something like that.
Pero en la segunda edición, la editorial decidió retirar este subtítulo porque había una palabra que molestaba. No hemos llegado a saber si la palabra que molestaba era culebrón o era entregas.
In the second edition, the publishing company decided that they will take out the subtitle because one of the words in the subtitle was disturbing for some people. But they never found out whether the disturbing word was soap opera or was installment.
During 5 years, I was anonymous. Nobody knows who was the author of these books. And I have a lot of anecdotes about this. If you want, I can explain you later. The following book, now with my name, Isabel Frank, was No Me Llames Cariño, Don't Call Me Honey, a story about violence against women. A serial murderer, a psycho killer, takes justice into her own hands, and a clumsy female police inspector tries to discover her. At that time, another publisher was interested in my work and proposed that I write a satirical version of the Jo Marx character, the most rebellious of a little woman, and Joe's reason to want war. The last book is this book about short stories that you have, some students have. So, one of the commitments I think is really important for a writer is how she or he uses the language. Because language is not innocent. Language is full of ideology. You project your ideology in the form you use the language. Look at this typical example. And I want to ask you, humor sense is appropriate.
No sé qué hacer con esto, tiene ya harto.
Is humor sense appropriate for women? No, absolutely not. I'm going to show you why. Is this feminine? Is this feminine? Hey. Is feminine? No. This is feminine. Well, what's the difference? Masculine is open, absolutely open, and feminine is closed. And humor is open. You must open your mouth to laughing. You must open your body to receive and to give humor. And you must open your mind to make humor, to work with humor. Humor must be cheeky, transgressive, daring, insolent, and all of these characteristics are not considered feminine. Now, I'm going to talk about, because we are talking, I was talking about language like a commitment. En las lenguas latinas, la mayoría de aquí lo saben porque están estudiando una lengua latina, el genérico se usa en masculino.
Mm-hmm. Right, so as many of you here know, because many of you here study some Romance or Latin language, in Roman languages, the generic is usually used as with the masculine. The masculine is used as a generic.
Es cierto que esta mañana lo comentábamos, es cierto que la Real Academia, real por la realeza, no porque sea verdadera, ¿no?
Yeah, she says that. We were discussing this morning, that according to the Royal Academy of the language, of the Spanish language, royal and real, it's the same word in Spanish, and she says it's actually more maybe royal because it belongs to the royalty, but not because it's real.
Bueno, es cierto que la Real Academia acepta que en una audiencia de 100 mujeres y un hombre se pueda usar el genérico en femenino, creo, más o menos, ¿no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So according to the Royal Academy of the Spanish Language, it is accepted that if you have an audience with 100 people and only one it's a male, you may use the feminine as a generic.
If there are two, no. Pero normalmente no se usa. O sea, normalmente el uso es masculino, el uso del genérico es masculino. Cualquier profesión, por ejemplo, que es algo que en inglés no ocurre, ¿no? O sea, hablamos de abogados, hablamos de médicos, hablamos de, menos mal, periodistas, palabras un poco que nos salva, etcétera, etcétera. Vamos a estar usando siempre el genérico en masculino.
Mm-hmm. So, although it is accepted to use the feminine as a generic word, the general rule is that we use the masculine for the generic. So for example, in the Romance languages, for when we talk about professions, when we talk about lawyers, doctors, all those words in Spanish, for example, they are marked with the masculine. Mm-hmm. Not in the case of journalists. That's one of the exceptions in which there is no masculine mark on that one.
Sucede lo mismo, por ejemplo, cuando hablamos de los padres. No decimos el padre y la madre. No decimos los cualquier palabra que pueda, parents, ¿no? Decimos los padres, y la categoría padre, estoy segura que todas las madres de aquí lo saben, es muy diferente a la categoría madre. Lo mismo ocurre con hermanos y hermanas. Vamos a tener que repetir, pero no repetimos. Vamos a decir, ¿cómo están tus padres? ¿Cómo están tus hermanos? Incluyendo a las mujeres de la familia.
So, also, for example, in Spanish or in other Roman languages, when we ask about someone's parents is a word that it's already marked with the masculine. It's like if you say, how are your fathers? Padres. So maybe we should say in Spanish, how are your mother and your father? Because as any mother will know, it's not the same being a father and being a mother. They're two different things. So maybe we should make sure that we ask about both people. Also, when we talk about siblings or brothers and sisters, maybe we should say brothers and sisters, because if we say in Spanish just hermanos, we're not referring to the sisters as well. Or, I mean, unless we may not be referring to, or they may not be felt included in there.
Esta es la norma. This is the norm. And I am sure it's a norm. I'm sure it's not a woman who invented this norm. Durante toda la vida, las personas que tenemos una lengua latina como lengua materna, yo desgraciadamente tengo dos lenguas latinas como lengua materna, o sea que tengo un cacao mental impresionante.
Sí.
¿Quieres?
No, sí, sí.
Sí, bien. Hemos tenido que imaginar si estábamos o no estábamos incluidas en el discurso, ¿no? Hay una anécdota muy, muy simpática que os voy a explicar, que es en una escuela de niños y niñas pequeñitos, la maestra dice: los niños que han terminado el trabajo pueden salir al patio. Y hay una niña en la primera fila con su trabajo terminado, y la maestra le dice: ¿has terminado el trabajo? Sí. Pues sal al patio. He dicho, los niños que han terminado el trabajo salen al patio. Ah, bien, la niña le entrega el trabajo y sale al patio. Al día siguiente, dice la maestra: los niños que quieren apuntarse al equipo de fútbol, que vengan a mi mesa. Y la niña va, y la maestra le dice: he dicho, los niños.
So, Isabel is explaining that in Spanish, well, for anyone who has a Latin language, a Romance language as your mother tongue, and in her case, in the case of people from Catalonia, they have two Romance languages, two Latin languages as their mother tongue, you never know whether you're included or not when people use the masculine message generic. So, for example, she has this anecdote about a teacher. Apparently, this is a real-life anecdote about a teacher who was in class, and the teacher said, using the generic masculine, she said something like, those boys, in English you wouldn't say boys, but using those students, but using a masculine, a word that it's in the masculine, those students who have finished their work, they may leave, they may go outside. So there was this female student who was in the classroom, and she was there with her homework finished, but she was waiting until the teacher would say, and those girls or something, those female students or something. But so she was there waiting, and then the teacher came up to her and said, have you finished? And she said, yes. So she said, why don't you leave? Why don't you go outside? I said, those students who have finished may go outside. And then the next day, so she left. So the next day, the same teacher was in class, and she said, those students, again using the generic masculine, those students who want to sign up for the soccer team, please come up to my desk. So this girl student went to her desk, and the teacher said, no, why are you here? I said, those students in the generic masculine who want to sign up. So in one case, she was included, in the other one, she wasn't included, but it's the same word in Spanish.
Well, in these circumstances, it's very, very complicated to use a non-sexual language. Because a lot of times we have to repeat, we have to say, los vecinos y vecinas afectados y afectadas por la inundación serán atendidos y atendidos por funcionarios y funcionarias.
So it's very difficult sometimes to use a non-sexist language. For example, she just said, if we don't use the masculine and the feminine, it would be those, we could say in English, avoiding the sexist language, we could say those affected by the flood need to go and talk to the administration or something like that. But in Spanish, you say those male people, those female people affected, also the participle goes in the masculine or in the feminine. So those female people, those masculine male people affected, feminine affected by the flood, need to go and talk to the female administrators, male administrators. So it's much longer.
Una lingüista catalana que ha trabajado muchísimo sobre el lenguaje no sexista dice que las mujeres toda la vida hemos tenido que saber por intuición si estábamos incluidas o no, y dice ella que este es el origen de la intuición femenina.
Very well-known Catalan linguists who has very widely studied the sexist language said once that a woman always had to figure out by themselves whether they were included or not included when they use the language. So she says that it's out of that intuition about knowing whether you're included or not. That's where the feminine intuition comes from, maybe.
So, in these circumstances, it's very difficult. So I decided to use the feminine like a generic. So I talk always in feminine in my books. ¿No? Digo, vinieron las bomberas, ¿no? Las taxistas, las policías, las mozas de escuadra, que es la policía autonómica de mi país.
So she says that, well, she said it in English, and then the words that she used were like the feminine generic for firefighters, for the police people, and all these different words. The police, I mean, in English you would just say the police if you want to avoid the sexist language. But in Spanish, again, you can use the masculine plural as a generic or the feminine plural as a generic. So in her books, as she said, she chose to only use the feminine as a generic.
This gives the sensation that in my novels, men doesn't exist, but it's not true. No, I promise you, not true. But all my life, I have wondered if I exist or not in universal literature. Maybe now it's the right moment to compensate for this injustice. Why not use the feminine form for the next 3 millennia, approximately, so we can balance the scales? It would be fair. Well, finally, I would like to end my talk with a short declaration of principles on the relationship between literature, human rights, and humans. In spite of its scanty prestige, especially in literature, it's not the same in cinema, I think that humor is a good narrative strategy. It's a way of saying and explaining reality, and in effect, a way to introduce some information that is not going to leave the readers indifferent, but is also a survival strategy. We are presented daily in the press, in our work, in our daily lives, with an endless number of attacks on our condition, our love lives, our ideological or political choices. Some people, besides for defending their own language or culture, other people must flee their country to survive. And if dialogue, reflection, and good words don't work, what is left? When we are near a nervous breakdown because of so many daily put-downs, so many insults, so much pain, and so much delirium, a brushstroke of humor is the only remedy. But it's also a worthy and a fierce response. Humor is the counterattack for those people who don't or won't accept diversity. It's a slap in the face of conservatism, whether if it comes from the right or from the left. It's a slap to constant scum for gay and lesbian culture, to homo and lesbophobia. It's a slap to incomprehension, intolerance, lies, and ignorance. And it's also a wonderful panacea for our problems of the heart, the eternal problems of the heart that cause us to use so many boxes of Kleenex. I think it's easy. In front of weapon, war. In front of intolerance, art. That must be our answer. And if it's possible, with a smile. Thank you very much for your attention, and thank you very much for the passion you have.
Y ahora las preguntas, ¿no? Ahora vienen las preguntas, ¿verdad?
Tenía un final muy bonito, ¿verdad? Pasado esto.
Yeah. Yes, now you questions. You want your papers?
I was just looking at the mic.
Oh, you have the mic. Okay, I don't know what that means.
No salía.
At this time, we've got a question and answer section, so if anyone wants to stay for that, if you have any questions for Ms. Brock, if you have to go, if you've got things to do, please try to leave quietly and be as non-disruptive as possible. Thank you.
I'll just wait a few moments, maybe so that we're going to wait until the room is a bit quieter, and then we can start with the questions and answers.
Is the mic up here if anyone has questions? Just raise your hand.
¿Puedes hablar un poco de la anonimidad que existía 5 años y los acontecimientos que tienen que relacionar con eso?
La verdad es que fue muy, muy, muy divertido porque nadie sabía quién era la autora de estos libros, entonces especulaba con nombres que a mí me llenaban de orgullo, ¿no? Uno de ellos, Terence Moshe, que tú debes conocer.
Claro.
Pero una de las anécdotas más divertidas es que iba a cenar a casa de mis amigas y me enseñaban mi propio libro, diciéndome, tú que eres escritora, ¿conoces este libro? Es muy divertido.
Right, yeah, so the question was, Alex asked if she could explain any anecdotes during that period of 5 years while she was not known as the author of those 3 books of that trilogy, and she said that it was a lot of fun because she would hear people speculate about different names, about who would be the author, and that made her very proud because some of the names that came out. Actually, for example, a very well-known Spanish author called Terence Moix. It's one of the persons that she was told maybe was the actual author of the book. So that made her very proud. And also, she would go to her friend's house for dinner, and they would come with the book and say, oh, I've read this new book that just came out, and it's really fun. Maybe you should have a copy. So
tuve la posibilidad de tener las críticas más sinceras. Creo que haya podido tener ningún autor.
Yeah, so she had the opportunity to have the most sincere criticism about her own book through that, you know, through being anonymous.
También ocurrió que mi peluquera se enfadó conmigo porque se vio reflejada en el libro y tuve que cambiar de peluquería, pero bueno, fue un problema menor.
Also, it happened that her hairdresser got angry at her because she saw herself reflected on the book and she didn't like how she was reflected, so she had to then go to a new hairdresser. She had to change hairdressers.
Better this one.
creo que a mí me toca. Sí, me suena. Voy a hacer la pregunta en español y luego en inglés. Veíamos hace tiempo, ¿no? Exactamente la transición que comentaste de la España conservadora, tradicional, de la dictadura, donde los Estados Unidos en los mismos años teníamos desfiles de orgullo gay, estamos muy adelantados, ¿no? Y creo que con esta nueva ley España nos ha pasado, ¿no? Y pregunto si tienes una explicación de esa transición, ¿no? Y especialmente sobre la ley de casamiento, ¿no? De cómo realmente formaron la pregunta de ese asunto para salir con éxito. Okay. The question in English. In past years, back in the Franco dictatorship, it seemed as if, in terms of gay rights, at least, that America was way ahead of Spain. And that in the last 30 years, Spain has not only caught up, but passed the United States in terms of gay rights. And the question was, how do you think, what happened with the passage of the spousal benefits, the gay marriage law in Spain? How did they form that issue so that it passed? And, you know, reflecting, of course, on how things are in the United States.
Yo creo que ha sido un conjunto de situaciones. Una de ellas, el hecho de que cuanta más represión hay, más reacción hay también. Entonces, tú dices, de una España conservadora, de una España fascista. O sea, una España en la que no se podía hablar la propia lengua, las lenguas autonómicas, catalán, euskera, etc. No se podía hablar de nada. Había la religión era una losa tremenda, la culpabilidad era continua. La lucha era mucho más fuerte, porque la represión era mucho más fuerte. Creo que esta ha sido una de las circunstancias. Otra circunstancia, el hecho de que se haya cambiado, se haya pasado a un gobierno socialista y a esta dualidad que cada vez es más universal, ¿no? Esta dualidad que en Estados Unidos existe desde hace mucho tiempo y que en países europeos ha habido una diversidad política mucho mayor, ¿no? El hecho de que cada vez se contrapongan más dos posiciones, que en realidad ninguna de las dos son extremas, bueno, una creo que sí, pero es la contraria a la que yo pienso, por supuesto. Esto hace que en cualquier situación unos quieran pasar por encima de los otros. Entonces, en el momento en que el gobierno socialista tomó parte del gobierno, que además ustedes saben que fue por una circunstancia muy dramática, es el atentado del 11M en Madrid, toda la lucha LGBT que se estaba llevando a cabo, muchos de los que estaban en esta lucha eran socialistas, pasaron al poder y la ley fue más fácilmente aprobada. Creo que fue un poco esto.
Right, so she says that she thinks this actually happened, this law was actually passed due to a number of circumstances that coincided in time. Also, I mean, the main reason is because the more repression you have, the more reaction you create on the people. So that means that Spain was a very conservative country. We had a fascist regime at the time. We had people could not speak some of the languages that we have in the country. We couldn't speak the original languages. Religion was very strong. Guilt was very strong at the time. So all this scenario created a big struggle against it. And so that's probably one of the reasons why when the new government took power in 1995, it was possible to, with that new government in power, to pass that law. She was explaining also that Spain was one of the countries that, together with the US or together with other European countries, we came to have this kind of duality in government. We have two big parties. None of them are very extremist. Well, maybe the other one, the one that the one in the opposition, not in the opposition, but the one who is not her party or her beliefs, maybe they're a bit extreme, but never mind. But in any case, they're not very extreme parties, and they change the they swap. Sometimes it's one government, other times it's the other government. And so what happened in the year 2003 is that for very dramatical circumstances due actually to some terrorist attack that we had in Madrid in the 11th of March 2003, the Socialist Party took over. And that was the situation that was then that made it possible to pass that law to allow same-sex marriages in 2005. Yeah.
También tengo que decir que nadie se lo creía. ¿Eh? Está pasando. O sea, era una cosa de... Bueno, ¿qué está pasando? Y luego ahora tenemos un problema grave. Porque yo, en la última boda heterosexual a la que fui, que era muy, muy joven, me juré a mí misma que no volvería a ir a una boda. Y ahora cada mes tengo una boda gay o lesbian y tengo que volver a comprar regalos, ponerme un vestido, etcétera. Es realmente una desgracia. Yeah. Porque todas mis amigas y todos mis amigos están casando.
So yeah, at the time in 2005, people really didn't really believe that it was possible to get married. They were like, "What's going on? How come this is possible now?" But I mean, it was a good thing at the end of the day. But the problem was maybe that when she was young, the last time she went to a heterosexual marriage, she thought, "Okay, this is the last time I'm going to a marriage. I'm not going to anymore." But now, gays and lesbians, they can marry. So now she's invited to all these weddings, and again she has to buy gifts, and she has to buy dresses, and she's invited like every month to go to a wedding. So that's a big personal tragedy, but you know.
And buy a present.
Buy presents.
En mi seminario de inglés leímos la novela The Namesake de Jhumpa Lahiri. Or Lahiri. En la novela el acto de eligiendo y cambiando su nombre es tienen grande importancia en la identidad. ¿Qué, en términos de usando un seudónimo, qué piensas sobre el nombre y la identidad?
Tengo un problema tremendo yo de identidad.
¿No entiende?
Sí, no, digo que tengo un problema de identidad. Porque tengo un montón de nombres diferentes y... Bueno, yo creo que, a ver, cuando naces a la vida, tu padre y tu madre te ponen un nombre. Pero cuando tú naces a algo en la vida, es bueno que te autobautices. Puedes estar muy orgullosa y muy contenta con tu nombre, puede que no. ¿No? En mi caso, Isabel Frank es mi nombre, pero no es mi apellido. Lo elegí porque justamente no quería usar mis apellidos. Quería mi nombre, que en origen es el nombre de mi madre y el nombre de mi abuela, el nombre de las mujeres de mi familia. Y quería autobautizarme para mi elección en la vida, que es la literatura. Porque además la literatura tiene esa opción de poder cambiar el mundo en muchos sentidos. Uno, en el sentido de que la realidad no te gusta, creas una ficción nueva y vives en esa ficción, o por lo menos convives en los dos mundos, realidad y ficción. Y tiene también esa posibilidad de cambiar, como decíamos en la charla, de gracias a la literatura, gracias al arte, gracias a toda la gente que tiene una actividad creativa, va a intervenir en los cambios sociales, ¿no? Entonces, está mi nombre real del documento de identidad, está mi nombre como escritora y luego está mi seudónimo Lola Vanguardia. Entonces, realmente, algunas noches no sé quién se va a dormir de las tres.
Right, so the question was about what does she think about names and identity? What's her opinion about names and identity? And she says that she has a big identity problem. That's really a big problem for her, the identity. She said that when you're born into life, your father and your mother, they choose a name for you. They give you a name. But then when later in life you are born into something that you choose, then it's a good thing to go through a self-baptism again, to find yourself a new name that identifies yourself with that role or with that world in which you have chosen to be. So, and this is a good thing about literature, that you can choose which name you want to use. So she was given a name where she was born, but she has chosen her last name when she made the decision that her life was going to be literature. And the good thing about literature as well is that you can change the world. You can create a fiction if you don't like reality, the reality you live in. You can choose to sometimes live in that fiction, sometimes live in that reality. And that's the good thing also when you're among people who are involved with literature, with art, with culture, that those are people that, thanks to them, society changes. Thanks to them, the social life changes. And that's the fun thing. So every day when she goes to bed, she doesn't know whether the person going to bed is Isabel Frank or is Lola Vanguardia or who is going to bed that day.
En español primero. Hablando del papel de la Iglesia Católica en la sociedad española, ¿cree usted que cómo van juntos? Que todavía hay una distancia en lo que dice, lo que cree la gente y lo que dice en las leyes.
¿Sí hay una distancia entre
la relación entre el papel de la Iglesia Católica en la sociedad y qué dicen las leyes, que cómo van?
En cuanto a derechos LGBT.
Sí, como que usted cree que todavía hay una distancia en lo que
sí, es evidente, y con el actual Papa mucho más, porque es un Papa muy conservador. Mucha gente pensábamos que podía haber un Papa un poco más progresista, pero ha salido el sector más conservador de la Iglesia Católica. Entonces esto va a enfrentar siempre. Incluso en España enfrenta al gobierno socialista, enfrenta con la Iglesia. Pero afortunadamente en el tema de derechos LGBT hay muchos cristianos gays o grupos de gente católica gay y lesbiana que se muestra abiertamente y que pone un poco un contrapunto a la ideología católica tan, tan, tan conservadora, por fortuna. Pero sí hay un enfrentamiento entre la Iglesia en las leyes, por ejemplo, la ley del aborto, la Iglesia evidentemente se implica en las leyes de reproducción asistida, se implica en el uso de células madre, se implica... desgraciadamente para la Iglesia Católica todo es pecado.
Right,
todo bueno, ¿no? Sobre todo lo bueno es más pecado todavía.
Eso es lo que voy a decir yo también. Right, so the question was about how does Isabel feel about the relationship between laws and society nowadays? How in Spain with the role, how is the role of the Catholic Church in Spain? And how does this role have to do with, where does it stand in relation to society and laws and so on? So she says that, it's very obvious that there is still a big gap between the laws and the society the society in which we live. Especially since we have this new Pope that is so conservative. We have a very, now, just a few years ago, it was elected a new pope, which is very conservatist. So this is a big problem, because that brings out the most conservative sector of the Catholic Church. For example, in Spain, often there is a confrontation between the government, between the socialist government that we have, and the church, because they have different opinions about different laws, for example, about abortion, about assisted birth, about stem cell research about different things. The government has an opinion, the church has a different opinion. So there is confrontation there. But luckily, within the LGBT community, there are Christian people, and they also make their point that it's possible to be Christian or to be Catholic and belong to this community. But, I mean, for the Catholic Church, what we were saying at the end is that for the Catholic Church, everything is sin, especially all the good things are sins. So, you know, it's very unfortunate.
Sí, en español. Soy español. Soy español. En tiempo de Franco, yo viví en tiempo de Franco.
Eras muy pequeñito también.
No, era grande.
Ya. Ah, ya era grande.
Pero, a las lesbianas le llamamos lesbiana. Sí. Había lesbiana. Y a los marguitas, los gays de ahora, se les decía marguitas o maricones.
Sí, sí.
He tenido grandes amigos marguitas y maricones. Y sigo teniéndolo. ¿Por qué el cambio del marguita a gay y la lesbiana sigue llamándose lesbiana?
Bueno, si quieres traducir la pregunta.
Yeah, he says that he says that also, I mean, he's Spanish, and he says that he was also living when we had the fascist government, when we had the dictatorship. He was alive, obviously, before the 70s, as you can see, very easily. And so he says that at that time, before 75, before the democracy, in Spain, lesbians were called lesbians, and gay men were called something different, something that maybe we could translate as queer, or we could translate, you know, we used a different word that that then was changed or was fell into misuse when gay men or gay or gays was used. So the question is, why we went from queer to gay, but lesbian are still lesbians? Basically, that's the question.
La respuesta es larga, ¿eh? La respuesta es larga. Primero, en época de Franco las lesbianas no existían. No se nombraban, no existían. Y esto era una ventaja en un sentido, porque dos mujeres podían ir cogidas de la mano por la calle, y no había ningún problema, y en cambio dos hombres eran encarcelados directamente. Pero es un problema a la larga porque seguimos intentando decir, ¿no? Aunque sea con lupa, hay alguna por ahí. Esto por una parte. Por otra parte está el problema de las terminologías. Todas las terminologías están cambiando. En época de Franco había inválidos, que es lo más despectivo del mundo para alguien que es muy válido para muchísimas cosas. Luego se pasó al minusválidos. No, al deficientes. Luego minusválidos. Esta mañana lo hablo, los traductores tienen un problema enorme cuando tienen que traducir todas estas palabras, porque hay cosas que políticamente son incorrectas, no las pueden decir, ¿no? Entonces ahora ya ni minusválidos ni sino deficientes, no, bueno, diferentes. Bueno, cada vez vamos a utilizar un eufemismo diferente para nombrar la diferencia, y es muy difícil nombrar la diferencia. Entonces, ¿qué pasa? Que las lesbianas lo que han querido es que se las nombre, de alguna manera, de la que sea. Y los homosexuales han pasado por las etapas, estas etapas de cambio de vocabulario lógico en todo el nombrar la diferencia, ¿vale? Pero ocurre un problema realmente fuerte con la palabra lesbiana. Es casi impronunciable. Hay muy poca gente que se atreva a pronunciarla. No sé en inglés, pero en castellano es casi impronunciable, ¿no? Entonces han sido las propias lesbianas las que han querido incluirse en la terminología. Ahora ya vamos por el LGBT, que es mejor LGBT que no GLBT. A mí me riñeron muchísimo. ¿Cómo tú, precisamente tú, pones GLBT en vez de LGBT cuando eres tan reivindicativa? Entonces esto va a pasar siempre a la hora de nombrar algo que socialmente es difícil de nombrar, de interpretar, de reconocer y de aceptar. La respuesta es larga.
Okay. Okay, so she said that it's a long answer. That's when I started to freak out. But no, she said that it was a long answer. She said that during the dictatorship, actually lesbians didn't exist because they were not named. In a way, it was an advantage because that meant that women could go hand by hand strolling in the street and nothing would happen to them because no one would know whether they're lesbians or they're not lesbians, they're friends. Whereas if a man was in hands with another man, then they could be taken to prison because they were infringing the law. So it was in a way it was a big advantage, but in another way you needed a magnifying glass to find lesbians, and that was also a problem because they wanted to be recognized, they wanted to be known, they wanted to be heard. But she explained that in terminology, there are always changes in terminology. For example, this morning we were discussing that when referring to handicapped people, there has been also an evolution in words used during the last few decades in Spanish and probably also in other languages, trying to always find a word that is more politically correct. So it's always a challenge to change. It's always looking for that euphemism. At the end of the day, it's about how to name the difference. And in the case of lesbians, they wanted to be named. They wanted to be recognized. So she says that in the case of Spain, lesbian is a word that it's very difficult for people to say. Many people are quite reluctant to use that word. So that means that lesbians sometimes feel like they are not included, they don't have visibility. For example, just with the case, now instead of talking about lesbians or gays and lesbians, now we can use LGBT. And she was told when she used LGBT, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender, and she was told, no, you shouldn't say GLBT. You should use LGBT. Lesbians should go first, before gays. So she was told, you shouldn't use LGBT. You shouldn't use GLBT. You should use LGBT. And so it's always that. A struggle about what word to use and so on. But at the end of the day, it's about naming the difference. How you name the difference? How you use the correct word? So I don't know if that was the end of the answer or whether the answer continues now.
No, estaba pensando, me ha recordado una anécdota que si tienes ganas de seguir trabajando,
claro.
La vamos a contar. En cuanto a la terminología. El sexo femenino tampoco ha sido nombrado nunca. A los niños, cuando son pequeñitos, está muy claro lo que tienen. Tienen un pene. Pero las niñas, ¿qué tienen? ¿No? ¿Cómo? Tienen una vagina, pero la vagina no la ven. ¿Dónde? ¿No? Dicen, ¿y qué tengo yo? ¿Dónde está? ¿No? Bueno, tienen una vulva. Bueno, sí, una vulva, ¿verdad? Es que además la palabra es tan horrorosa que ya... Digo, la terminología para el sexo femenino en todos los idiomas del mundo es lo más vulgar que puede existir. ¿Eh? ¿Quieres que pare aquí? Porque la anécdota todavía no ha empezado.
Sí, vamos a hacer hasta ahí. Y así seguimos. Sí. She says that also all this conversation made her remind her of also terminology about the feminine sex. How do people call the feminine sex? It's not always something that you want to, a word that people use very freely. In the case of boys, when they're born, you say they have a penis. Okay, so everybody agrees on that. But if it's a girl, what do you say? I mean, you don't say she has a vagina because you can't see it, So, but you don't say she has a vulva. It's the same word in English, right? Because it's a very ugly word, so you don't use that word either. So any word that has to do with the feminine sex is very vulgar. So it's very difficult to name the feminine sex in any language. But we have an anecdote coming up.
La madre fácilmente juega con el objeto sexual, no, el aparato sexual, mm-hmm. el órgano, perdón.
El órgano.
La madre fácilmente juega con el órgano sexual masculino y dice, uy, qué pistolita, qué pitito tiene mi niño, ¿no? 50.000 palabras monísimas para el sexo masculino. Pero ¿qué le dice a la niña? Uy, qué vulvita tan mona tiene, ¿no? Posible, ¿no? Entonces, yo durante muchos años fui enseñante de niños y niñas con handicap mental leve, que luego pasaron a ser integrados. En la escuela donde trabajábamos, esto os hablo de años, pues 79-80, ¿eh? O sea que... Entonces decidimos, éramos todos profesores muy jóvenes, todo el mundo, decidimos hacer unas clases de educación sexual. Bueno, en realidad solo eran clases de información anatómica. Quedaron en información anatómica. Pero por lo menos íbamos a dar un nombre a los órganos masculino y femenino. Con los niños no tuvimos problema. Los niños tienen pene. Con las niñas, bueno, al final buscamos todos los manuales de la época y parece ser que lo que íbamos a decir es que las niñas tenían vagina. Bueno, esto es una broma solo para que puedan entender los niños y el peine y la vajilla, pero bueno, esto ya era una cosa. El niño tiene peine y la vajilla. Es igual. Decidimos estos dos nombres. Los niños tienen pene y las niñas tienen vagina. Entonces yo tenía un alumno muy simpático, muy muy simpático, pero muy despistado, tremendamente despistado, un poco gay además. Yo estaba con las niñas bailando, se sabía todas las canciones, pero de las cosas de la clase no seguía. Entonces un día la llamé a mi mesa para ver cómo iba con el tema este y le dije, a ver, Antonio, ¿cómo se llama lo que tienen los niños? Y él me dijo, yo qué sé. Antonio, por favor, ¿cómo se llama lo que tienes tú? Ay, yo qué sé. No, Antonio, por favor, ¿cómo se llama? Oiga, pero si lo hemos dicho mil veces, ¿cómo se llama lo que tienes tú ahí? No había manera. Al final le digo, se llama el pene, ¿de acuerdo? De acuerdo. Y le pregunté, ¿y cómo se llama lo que tienen las niñas? No tuvo ninguna duda. Directamente me dijo, pues la pena. Y yo pensé, niño visionario donde los haya, niño visionario, es cierto, los hombres tienen pene y las mujeres tenemos una pena muy grande de no saber qué narices tenemos en órgano sexual, ¿no? Okay. ánimo.
Right. Okay, where were we? Yes, do we have... We end it here?
After you summarize.
Oh. Okay, yeah, so she was explaining that, a mother, for example, would be, when they have a baby boy, it's easier for them also, for example, to play around with the baby boy organ. They can say, oh, look at your little weapon here, look at your little thingy here. But when it's a baby girl, what do they say? What can they say? They cannot say, look at your little vulva or look at your little vagina. It's not the same. It's not as nice. So she explained the anecdote that at the end of the 70s, she was a teacher, and she was a teacher for slightly handicapped, mentally handicapped children. And at that time, she wanted to introduce, there was a bunch of young professors and teachers, and they said, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do something new. We're going to do sex ed. We're going to teach some sex ed for the children, for our students. They did that, but actually, eventually, it was just teaching anatomy. It was just anatomical information more than sex ed, what they did. But so basically, it was about calling, saying, or teaching the names of the feminine and the masculine organs. So for the boys, it was clear the word that they would teach would be penis, And then for the girls, but don't you all look at me as I'm saying, you know, something, I'm saying bad words or something. No, anyway. So for the boys, it was penis, but for the girls, they had to look up all the manuals, all the dictionaries, and eventually they decided that they will teach the students that what the girls have are vaginas. So it was fun to teach them those two names. So she had this student who was very funny. Maybe he was a bit gay. He was always playing around with the girls and dancing around, and he knew all the songs and all that. But he wasn't a very good student. So Isabel called the student to her desk one day, and she wanted to check whether the student had learned the two names properly. And so she said, okay, Antonio, what do boys have? How do you call what boys have? And she said, well, I don't know. And she said, okay, come on, Antonio, what do you have? And I said, I don't know. So she explained again, okay, what you have is called the penis. Okay. So what I have is the penis, and then which is in Spanish, as you heard, is el pene, and then and she asked, okay, and then what is what girls have? And he said, yeah, okay, I know that. If guys have the penis, girls have the pena, which in pena, so pena, is like the feminine, but pena actually means pity in Spain, in Spanish. So the boys have the penis, and the girls have pity. They have just pity. That's what they have. So she says that this was a very visionary student. He really knew what was coming up. So that was the anecdote. Parece que ya no tenemos mucho más tiempo. No, vaya, si quieres decir algo más.
No. Muchísimas gracias. Thank you very much. And I have enjoyed a lot this moment.
You want to say something?
This concludes this evening's event. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Spanish Department, and the Office of Global Education, we'd like to thank you again for coming, and thank Ms. Bronk for speaking tonight, and thank Mr. Lopez for translating. The Spanish Department also would like to put in a quick reminder that there are two etapas. In Help Side Room 205. So everyone's invited.
No? Oh.
Wow.
Now? Is that now?
I think so.
Now, okay.
Yes. So, all right, thank you.